You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Today, President Obama expanded his idea of promise zones, something he first mentioned in his 2013 State of the Union address.
The plan is to give 20 areas of the country, hit especially hard by the recession, comprehensive federal funding. President Obama announced the first five today.
Marco Rubio, Republican senator from Florida, also unveiled an anti-poverty plan this week. He wants to give federal funding to the states, who he says are better equipped to deal with regional issues.
Here to break down some of these different approaches to fighting poverty nationwide and put them in context is Ron Haskins. He's senior fellow and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. Ron, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So we've got these promise zones. This isn't the first time we've seen this kind of focused anti-poverty strategy targeting an area. Can you give us a little background on these geographically based anti-poverty plans?
Right. Several countries have tried this. The U.S. has done it many times in the past. They used to be called enterprise zones and other terms. But the basic idea is, the most important ideas are similar. First of all, that there'd be some kind of tax relief, especially for businesses, hoping that they would be able to locate there or expand there and that they would have some relief from taxes, which would give them a slight advantage. And the hope is that they would either come there or expand and that they would hire more workers, so there would be an opportunity for people to work. There might also be relief from regulations, from federal, state, local regulations. A problem with pontificating too much about this now is that we don't really know very many details. There has been research on the enterprise zones and similar approaches in the past, and I think it's fair to call it mixed. It certainly is nothing like a silver bullet. There are criticisms, and there are some research found good outcomes, that there have been increases in employment, so at least to that extent it worked. The president also intends to build into this several other aspects other than just the economic changes and the tax relief and so forth. He wants schools to be involved, and he wants civic organizations to be involved in all these groups, including local businesses, to work together to have a plan for increasing employment, reducing poverty, and making more use of government resources. And that all sounds good, and if it could be done successfully, it would be good, but it's very difficult to do. Let me make one other point about it, and that is there are some elements of this plan that are really quite bipartisan. In fact, I previously thought it to be impossible that you could do anything that would get Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, this two senators from Kentucky, to actually praise something the president did. And they both did that today because one of the five zones that was announced today is Kentucky. I think it's a part of eastern Kentucky that's particularly devastated by the recession and even for a longer period than that. So there are some bipartisan parts here, especially the focus on local government and on civic organizations and trying to coordinate business and local government. Those are ideas that Republicans really like. So there are possibilities for some cooperation here.
It seems like one of the core philosophical ideas here is saying poverty relief isn't just about an individual. It isn't finding a person in poverty and connecting them to this program and that program. It's an environmental issue. It's a social issue. We've got to tackle education and job growth and all these other things instead of looking at individuals. Do I have that right? Is that the sense that you're getting from Promise Zones?
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. I think that, in fact, we have a lot of data and studies that show that opportunities vary quite dramatically around the country. I mean, you can imagine, and this goes all the way back to the founding of the War on Poverty, and even before that, to President Kennedy, you may remember, or probably most of your viewers are too young to remember this, but he made a very famous trip to Appalachia and seemed to at least personally discover poverty. He didn't have too much poverty in his background. And there was a lot of attention to areas that are really quite devastated. Employment is a huge problem, declining businesses and so forth, and we have that. You always have that in a capitalist economy. There'll be places that the economy will not be alive and well, and so it's hard for people to get jobs, and poverty is pervasive. So these so-called place-based programs are, on the face of it at least, make a lot of sense. It's trying to get them to work that's very difficult.
Let's look at the places announced today. We've got three urban areas, parts of San Antonio, Texas, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and then you mentioned southeastern Kentucky, more of a rural area, and the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. What do you think about the diversity of those hard-hit economic areas?
Well, I think that's a wise thing to do. If I were going to do it, I would start out with as much diversity as possible as well. Especially because I don't think we know from research that this approach is bound to be successful. So try it in as many different places and carefully evaluate it. I think that is really a key here. We need to know whether these things are going to work. This president has been more focused on evidence and trying to base decisions on evidence, starting with the very first inaugural. He said, we're going to expand what works and we're going to cut or try to improve what doesn't work. And that's really a key here. If I were, if I had a chance to quiz the president and his staff, that's the first thing I would ask them. Tell me your plans to figure out if this is working. And that's for two reasons. One is the basic concept of place-based strategies and enterprise zones, or promise zones, as he wants to call them. We need to know if something like that can be made to work, and hence this idea of trying it in as many different places as possible. But the second thing is that it's helpful for people who are trying to implement it to have continual feedback on whether they're being successful, because if they're not, maybe they can adjust and they can improve their performance if they have reliable information. So that, I think, is a key part of this. It's not mentioned in anything that I've seen so far.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me how you would measure something like this. There are so many variables. I mean, yep. An education system, cultural background, crime, whether this factory flips a coin and opens up here or 10 miles away. There's so many variables. How do you start to measure success?
Very difficult. You're exactly right. That's one of the reasons that people are cautious when they read the literature on enterprise zones or promise zones, that, you know, there are so many variables. It's so difficult to measure. And some people would even say it's impossible. There are just too many different things going on. One way to do it, there are two ways that would give you some valuable information, I think. One is to measure over time to see if there are improvements. Does employment go up? Do kids do better in school? Do graduation rates go up? Do young adults, are they more likely to go to school? Are they more likely to go to community colleges? Are they more likely to get a job? So over time, if those things improve, that's circumstantial evidence. It's not necessarily definitive, but it's very useful information. And then the other way is to try to pick out other communities that are similar that don't have the program, and to compare what goes on in the promise zone communities, the five you just mentioned, and others are going to be named over the next year or year and a half, I think, and compare them with other communities that are similar. I hope that the president's people are already trying to pick out communities like that, maybe even more than one, to compare them to see if there are improvements in the promise zones that do not occur in the similar communities.
One of the things the White House made a big point of was saying, hey, these are communities that came to us. We invited these plans, but these communities, mm-hmm. they're government leaders, I think civic leaders, put together plans, and we reviewed them, and we're participating. How important is local leadership, a big local stake in coming up with the Promise Zone plan?
I think it's hugely important, but it's, again, very difficult to do. I've had the opportunity to work with a number of local groups in Buffalo and Norfolk and in other cities, and the people that are trying to pull together, they often represent the schools, and they represent the Department of Social Services, often the mayor's office, and so forth. But it's very difficult to make those groups to work together. The individuals often are leaders in the community, and they do try to work together. But to get these big organizations to pull in the same direction is very difficult, but it has to be tried. In fact, I would go so far as to say that if you don't have local buy-in and they can't make progress in trying to all pull in the same direction, the projects will fail.
And speaking of pulling in different directions, this is, I think, bringing together efforts from five federal departments, education, housing, urban development, and others. How important is that, making sure these bureaucracies are all pointed in the same direction here?
I think it's important, but I think it's less important than the local buy-in. The president presumably has quite a bit of control over the federal agencies. In fact, I've recently been involved in a study where I've interviewed people in not every agency you just mentioned, but several federal agencies. And I have been impressed by the degree to which these agencies work with the Federal Office of Management and Budget, which is really the kind of the budget and operations arm of every president. And that's quite impressive. So I do think that they probably have laid this plan pretty carefully. Many of these agencies have experience with similar programs, and there's at least a chance that they'll be able to work together. But even if they do, the local buy-in and the local coordination is still going to be crucial.
We're talking about federal anti-poverty efforts proposed this week. Promise zones we've been talking about. President Obama gave some details today. And coming up, we'll talk about Senator Marco Rubio calling on something like block grants, letting states make the decisions. Ron Haskins is with us. He's with the Brookings Institution.
And we'd like to know what you think about President Obama's plan to combat poverty and looking ahead at Marco Rubio's plan as well. Do you think it will help? And which approach do you think is going to fit the bill better? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're speaking now with Ron Haskins, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution.
We're talking about federal anti-poverty efforts. President Obama took the next steps in his Promise Zone plans, announcing the first 5 of 20 communities that will be declared Promise Zones, get some tax breaks, efforts to boost education, fight crime, among other things in those areas. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Marco Rubio wants state governments to call the shots. We'll talk about what he has proposed this week in a little bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your reactions to what you heard from the president today. What do you think should the federal government do to fight poverty in the United States, or not do for that matter? 800-642-1234. John in Rhinelander has some thoughts on Promise Zones. We'll go to him now. John, hi, you're on the air.
Aren't these tax breaks targeted at certain areas just another form of trickle-down? It's a tax cut for business that's targeted at a certain area. We found out that the trickle-down stimulus doesn't really work. The better stimulus would be boosting minimum wage and, say, making the Social Security payments progressive so that people on the lower end of the scale didn't have to pay in as much for Social Security. That would, in effect, boost their hourly wages, too. And that's a direct stimulus to the economy. All that money is spent, and it's magnified through the economy. Much better stimulus than trickle-down.
John, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Ron? It's almost sort of a supply-side versus demand-side argument there.
Well, the minimum wage is the opposite of what the president is trying to do. He's trying to give incentives to employers to come to an area. If you have a higher minimum wage, that would make them less likely to come, and it would also impose costs upon them. So that's the opposite of what the president is trying to do. And Social Security, which is not in the president's proposal, but it's already progressive if you consider both the benefits and the taxes to pay for it. So we're already doing half of what the caller recommends, and the minimum wage is not part of this proposal for sure.
And I think when people talk about minimum wage, usually it's an all or nothing, either the entire state or, I guess, a national minimum wage, not targeting it in one community is – well, I guess there are living wage proposals in some cities. But
yes, and states have different minimum wages, and some cities have minimum wages. So it could be local. It could be state. It could be federal. The discussion now, of course, at the federal level is that there should be a new federal minimum wage of $10.10, I think, is the – is the one that's being most discussed now. It's important to point out, Americans should understand that we have a program at the federal level, and many states, including Wisconsin, also have. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And what that does is it gives a wage subsidy, and so it has the same exact effect as a minimum wage. It gives a wage subsidy to low-income workers, mostly who have children. There's one for workers who don't have children, but it's very modest. And it can be up to $5,000. It was a crucial part of welfare reform because the idea in Wisconsin and all over the country was if moms went to work at low-wage jobs, they would get subsidies through food stamps, but most importantly, through their income tax credit. I think that's a much better way to boost the wages of low-income workers than to do it through the minimum wage, especially because it's so to speak, socialized. It's paid for by taxes, which are very progressive. The upper 20% of taxpayers pay about 85% of the taxes, and that's a source of income to support these low-wage, low-income workers. So it's a much better approach.
Wanted to mention Senator Marco Rubio now. He was talking this week, a lot of people talking about poverty with the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty. His concept, something along these lines, streamline federal anti-poverty funding into one federal agency. That agency gives grants to states and lets states, innovate, figure out how they want to use this money to tackle poverty and be more responsive to their own particular regional needs. What do you think of that basic concept? Not very fleshed out yet, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think it's very fleshed out either. But the basic idea, as you just stated it, I think is a good idea. You have to be very careful about accountability mechanisms because, we have corruption in states. States like Wisconsin have it. Terrific tradition of being innovative and trying new things and carefully evaluating and having accountability. But there are many states that, you might be a little bit concerned about that. The other point about his proposal, though, is that he would try to separate aid for working families from aid for families that are not expected to work. And the states would run the aid for families that are not expected to work. Excuse me.
That's okay. I'll go to the phones now. We've got Mike in Cross Plains with us now. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Here in Wisconsin, it seems that our governor has been somewhat disinclined to accept federal money based on principle. Would he also disincline? Do you think he would also disincline the federal money on these block grants? Rather than, say, Milwaukee was a promise zone, and that's my basic question, in a state like Wisconsin where our governor seems philosophically against accepting federal money, how would that the block grants work for us? Thank you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Ron, what do you think? Would there be governors, perhaps like our own, who might not take the federal money?
No, I don't think any governors would do that. First of all, the money's already been spent in the states. So this is already existing funding, some of which already comes to the states, but they would get even more. And I don't see any prospect that any state would turn it down.
All right. We're talking to Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution about federal anti-poverty efforts with President Obama's announcement of the first five promise zones. I'll remind you of those. They are San Antonio, Texas, Los Angeles, California, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, southeastern Kentucky, and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. A lot of talk this week about poverty with the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty. So, Ron, if they came to you and said, set aside our promise zones, set aside what Marco Rubio had to say, what should be our first priority as we try to tackle poverty from the federal government? What would your first steps be?
I would want to try both of them. I think they both have at least some promise. I'm especially enticed by the Rubio proposal because I want to make a clear distinction between helping families that can work and do work and give them more incentive to work, which is part of his plan, from families that are not expected to work. I think we're not going to make good progress against poverty until we have more working families. That is really a key. We've had a long-term decline in men working. We've had an increase in women working, especially single women up until recently, but we haven't recovered from the recession yet, so there are fewer women who are working, single moms who are working. And unless they can work and we subsidize their income, which is part of the Rubio plan, they cannot get out of poverty. Most Americans don't understand this. You cannot get out of poverty by just taking welfare. You have to work, and then the public subsidizes your income, especially through the earned income tax credit, which is what Rubio would want to focus on.
And your main point was separating those two groups, those who can work and those who can't. There's been a concern with welfare, with anti-poverty programs over the years that it's a disincentive to go to work if you are losing your benefits when you go from public assistance of some sort to working. Why would you go to work?
Yes, but I can tell you that really is a thing of the past. We have changed these welfare programs now so that even people who go to work get more money than if they were just on welfare if you combine it with their earnings. The earned income tax credit, for example, they cannot get while they're on welfare, and that could be as much as $5,000 per family, plus the child tax credit, same thing, $1,000 per child. So you could easily imagine a mom with two kids could get up to $7,000, and she wouldn't get a penny of that if she didn't work. So we really have created a system that already has strong incentives, and the Rubio proposal is to focus on that distinction even more and try to improve the wage supplements for workers even more, for example, by paying them. We now pay it only once a year and pay it more frequently, probably with each paycheck or once a month or something like that. As you pointed out before, these ideas are not fleshed out. We don't know the details. The details are crucial for every program like this. But there are possibilities here, and that's why I think we should try to move ahead with both of these programs.
And before I let you go, we've got 15 more promise zones to be announced over the next 3 years. If you had the opportunity, could you pick out a couple of regions, a couple of places in the country that might make promising additions to the promise zone concept?
Well, every state has areas that are in bad shape. I think I would focus it on areas that are having economic difficulty, and I would make sure that if there's any disproportionate focus here, it would be on inner city. I think the inner cities have, for a long time, needed a lot more than we're able to do, and the poor are concentrated in inner cities. I mean, rural areas are an issue, too, especially for a state like Wisconsin, but inner cities like Milwaukee have enormous problems, and enormous percentage of our poor people live there, and more to the point, their kids live there, and their schools are not very good. They often don't have good public services and so forth. So if anything, I would focus on inner cities.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
That's Ron Haskins, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution.